Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks a lot for attending our analyst conference this year. We will have a little bit of an extended agenda today. We will present the full set of figures following the preliminaries 2 weeks ago for financial year 2017, and we will also comment on the latest acquisition of company Orlandi, which you might be familiar with. And Mr. Bockhardt and Mr. Dr. Heiden will take turns in presenting the figures and also the Orlandi takeover. Afterwards, you can ask questions as always, and we will invite you, please use the opportunity for a small reception afterwards.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. My name is Detlef Bockhardt, CEO of the company. Also, a warm welcome from my side, Stefan. Thanks for the introduction. In light of the latest acquisition, I should say buongiorno, come sta, but I will not continue in Italian because I'm not sure if everybody speaks Italian here, but I will do it in English. Yeah, we have a pretty busy agenda today, as Stefan mentioned already, and I will guide you through this. I will start today with the highlights of the business year, of the last year, 2017, talking about sales, our profitability, especially also about Q4, the last quarter of last year. I will talk about markets, market trends, where are we right now, and what do we expect for the remainder of the year. Then following by Matthias, who will talk about in the financials, guide you through all the numbers more in detail. We will talk about the outlook for this year, and then a couple of slides at the end of the presentation about Orlandi, which I will do later on. Yeah, with this, I would like to jump right into the presentation. I'm on page 3 now for everybody who is online listening to us. Business summary, sales, first thing. Last year in 2017, we saw very good demand, very good markets in the three main truck and trailer markets, which is Europe, North America, and China. All three markets developed very well. You will see the numbers later on. And, of course, we are market player in these markets, and that was both for trucks and trailers. In numbers, and you can see that on the first bullet point, sales picked up, or sales revenue picked up by 9.3%, equaling to 1.138.9 million euros, compared with the previous year of 1.042 billion. We had some negative effects from currency. That was 9.1 million. But our sales contribution from our inorganic growth, that was KLL, our Brazilian company, which we took over in September 2016, that was 9.2 million, so both effects more or less balanced out. When we look to the organic sales, as I said, 9.3% increase, that was already, even above our upward guidance, which we did in October 2017, where we said we will end last year, between 1.125 and 1.135, that was then even higher than the original planned numbers and 1.09 billion euros. Again, later on, I will show you some market figures and will explain again why we budgeted this year only, last year was only 1.090 billion, and now finally finished that with 1.138 billion. Yeah, in Q4, the sales momentum continued. We increased sales compared with the previous year, Q4, by 8.6%, equaling 274 million euros. We had also some negative currency effects in Q4 that came in with 11.4 million. So if you look to the organic sales only, our growth was a double digit by more than 13%. So you can see the market developed over the last year, and Q4 was really a very busy year for almost all our factories. Yeah, that was about the sales development as some highlights. On the next slide, I would like to talk about the profitability. Adjusted EBIT margin came in as a target range, despite a lot of issues in North America. We will talk about this today very much in detail, so to be very transparent. Overall, our adjusted EBIT increased in the financial year 2017 to 91.2 million euros, compared with 90.4 million euros in 2016. As expected, our EBIT margin came in the corridor between 8% and 9%, unfortunately at the lower end, exactly 8%, compared with a previous year number of 8.7%. Most of the biggest reason for that was the swift increase in demand from our U.S., or let's say North American, truck and trailer customers, and that came in right at the same moment when we have been in the middle of our huge plant consolidation in U.S. Again, we will talk about that later on even more in detail. We had some, on top of that, some negative impact from steel price increase, and of course a very unfavorable product mix, which is always the same, as most of you know. If markets are going up, then the mix is not the best one, because most of the customers ask for standard products, standard fifth wheels, standard axles, suspensions, no specialties or less specialities, or this comes in with lower margins. And on top, and that is really the negative effect, if you have limited capacity, then you serve OEMs first. That is a must. There's no other way around that. And then you don't serve the aftermarket, or you don't serve the aftermarket 100%. In the aftermarket, our spare parts business is much better in profitability than the OE business. So both mix on the OE side, more standard, plus less aftermarket, that leads to an unfavorable product mix. We have a significant impact on earnings from the implementation of the plant consolidation. You will see the numbers later on much more in detail. Just as some headlines here, we had 10.9 million in on-time restructuring costs in U.S. only. Totally restructuring costs last year have been 13.2 million. And this was mainly to relocation costs, impairment of tools and equipment, and severance payments. These 13.2 million were adjusted for. On top, we had 10.3 million euros on unplanned additional costs due to the plant consolidation, which were fully accounted in the EBIT. So if we come to the last bullet point here, the reported EBIT compared with the adjusted EBIT achieved 72.7 million compared with previous year number of 78.4 million euros. On the next page, I would like to elaborate on Q4 only last year. We saw the highest impact, negative impact on earnings from the U.S. plant consolidation in Q4 last year. One of the reasons is that the OE business picked up even more, up to 13.7% organically. And of course, if markets are so hot and you're right in the middle of the plant consolidation, that does not really help. The 1.7 million one-time restructuring cost in Q4, out of that 1.6, so 90-whatever percent, was due to the U.S. And that have been re-added to the adjusted EBIT. Bullet point number three, we had 6.3 million euros in Q4 only from higher operating costs. Just for comparison, in Q3, we had 4 million euros for the U.S. plant consolidation, and all this were fully booked into the EBIT. In Q4, and this is one of really, from my point of view, one of the lowlights of today, the adjusted EBIT in the Americas region was negative by 3.9 million euros. You will see later on the comparison to the previous year. Let me do a very brief detour here. The reason in 2006 when we acquired Holland and then in the following years to increase business in other regions like China, Australia, Middle East, Brazil, etc., was to be more independent from one single market. SAF at the old time was Europe, more or less Europe only, and with some volatile developments, it was always a problem if markets go down. And you're only in one market with just one product. At that time, it was trailer products. And then you are highly dependent on this. So the idea to form SAF Holland and with all the export activities around the world was to have a more balanced sales structure. And that's exactly what you can see now what happened in Q4. U.S. was down. Our numbers had been down. The market was high, okay. But U.S. was pretty much down, as I told you, 3.9 million minus. But the other reasons, Europe, and especially China, picked up very, very nicely, So we have been able almost to balance out the negative effects from U.S. So that means the strategy works, as you can see, and we had seen really nice development in Europe and China, the numbers you will see later on. Overall, in Q4, the group adjusted EBIT came in with 18.5 million compared with 19.8 million in the previous year. The adjusted EBIT margin in Q4 came in with 6.7% compared with 7.8% in the previous year. Yeah, that's about the highlights in 2017 and the highlights in Q4, some negative and some positives. I would like to talk a little bit about the market trends 2017, what happened, and what might happen in this year. Let me talk about 2017 first, and you see all the numbers here. This is a very well-known chart, which we always present here. Let me start with the global trailer market first. On the first line, you see North America. And what you can see in 2017, both ACT and FTR are pretty close, roughly 315,000 trailers. As a reminder, when we started the business year 2017, the forecast was for the trailer business minus 14%. When we did the budget in October, it was minus 16%. So instead of a steep decrease in the market, we saw very stable development, even a plus here, with almost the same number than 2016. So totally unexpected change in the market. In Europe, last year was absolutely stable, roughly 300,000 trailers, so a very nice development, very stable development in Europe. When you look to the last years, always about above 260, 280, 300,000 trailers, so very stable. And that was predicted, so this is right on top. If I go to this year, 2018, what are the forecasts? In North America, ACT see a plus 5%. FTR, as usually, is always a little bit more conservative. The conservatives see almost the same number. And the trailer business in North America counts for approximately 20% of our total sales. Even more important is Europe, with 40% of total sales of SAF Holland related to the European trailer market. The predictions are minus 5%. We don't see that so far. Our order intake is strong, is still very strong. We are running under full steam in our European plants, and so we cannot see the 5% right now. It might change in the second half of the year, but it's too early. We are in March, and you know normally our visibility is 6 to 8 weeks, not longer. So really, we don't know. We talk to fleets every day, we talk to the OEMs every day. Nobody seeing this 5% so far. But after this very good development over the last years, sooner or later, the market will normalize. And the 300,000 or 300,000 plus level is a very high level. Again, we will see. The big question marks are the markets like Russia, Turkey, and the Middle East. Russia came back last year very nicely, but coming from an extremely low level in 2015 and 16. So we are very pleased with Russia right now. How this will continue, we don't know. Turkey is still very low. We see roughly 50-60% less, or we saw roughly 50-60% less last year than compared with 2016. And for this year, we see almost no improvement there. So, but if Russia will continue to grow to normal levels, and Russia is the third biggest market in Europe, according and in the trailer market, and if Turkey might come back, plus the Middle East regions, which we don't know, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Dubai, Syria, and all these markets, nothing is going on. It's very, very quiet. So it could happen if the Western European trailer markets will go down, maybe by 5%, if the other markets will pick up at the same time, it will be a wash. Again, it's too early to talk about that. We don't know. So far, and I repeat myself, we don't see any negative trends in Europe in the trailer business. It continues on a very high level. Yeah, coming to the truck market, this is line number 3 and 4 here on this chart, starting with North America. Also very interesting development last year. The prediction for 2017 was -8%. What we see now is a plus, or we saw now, is a +9 or +12%. So totally the opposite. That means both for the trailer and truck market for North America, the forecast, all the predictions for 2017 have been totally wrong. For this year, 2018, you see a very nice number there, +26%. We see that in our order intake. The North American, especially Class 8 truck market, is booming. Not so much Class 7, but we are more in the Class 8 product range. So that looks quite well, and we believe that will probably also continue in 2019. But also, this is too early to talk about it, but 2017 and was a good year, and 2018 will be an even better year. On the Western and European truck market, you see last year +5%, and this year another plus, up to around 500,000 trucks, which will be a very, very high number. This is good to us, but I need to remind everybody that European truck market stands only for less than 4% of our total sales, so any ups and downs you hardly see in our numbers. So overall, both markets, Europe and North America, are in a good shape. Outlook is positive. Let me add a little bit flavor to other markets like China, Brazil, and Australia. China, we saw last year a booming market, both in truck and trailer. I reported, or we talked about it already last time. This year, Chinese trailer market will probably go down by 20%. This is not an issue at all because we're coming from an extremely high level. Last year, there are no numbers really available, no official numbers, but we believe last year in China have seen roughly something between 500,000 and 600,000 trailers, which is a number I've never seen before. For us, and this is important, you will see the numbers later on, how we increased our business in China very, very nicely. We are in the premium segment only. That means if the Chinese trailer market will go down by 20% this year, okay, so be it. This is standard. Okay, we are not in this business. This is okay. The premium business is growing rapidly. I will come later on when I talk about China in specific. Come back to that later, but the Chinese market is still on a very high level. The same is for truck, but we are not in the truck business so far in China. So overall, also China is still booming. Brazil coming back strongly, but from an extremely low level. I was in Brazil 3 weeks ago, saw some big customers, and with our latest acquisition, no, the latest was today, but our last acquisition, which was in September 2016, when we acquired KL, the momentum is very positive in Brazil. Everybody's talking about more, more, more. Do you have enough capacity? Can you serve me? So this is always a good sign. So we might see a +20% on truck and trailer in Brazil this year, but again, coming from almost nothing. Okay, so anyhow, the outlook for Brazil is positive as well. Australia is also a nice improvement. Mining industry is coming back. Mining means truck, trailer, transport. And so also this is quite positive. Yeah, that's about the market trends 2017 and the outlook for 2018, as far as we know. With this, I would like to hand over to Matthias to guide you through the financials more in detail.
Thank you, Dennis. Good morning, everyone, also from my side. Good to see you again and be back. Sincere apologies for having missed the preliminaries. Flu had kept me in bed, but you see I am up and running, and all the merrier to be with you today. What I'll do right now is take you through the financial sections, as usual, a bit visualization to make it easier to digest the business highlights that Lev usually presents at the beginning, and also shed some additional light on some of the topics. If I start here with the bridge to underline what was said around the organic sales growth, 9.3%, with FX and M&A canceling each other out across the year this time around, so that the 9.3% or almost 100 million euro is the real number. To point out for you in your analysis of Q4, you will see missing the M&A component in this bridge. Why is that the case? Because Q4 2016 was the first quarter when KLL had been included in the scope of consolidation, just so that nobody gets confused when looking at the numbers. If you look at Q4 alone, organic growth was 13.1%. Let's look a little closer where that came from. The positive message on this slide is it came from all regions, all regions growing healthily. We're very happy about that. However, let's take a closer look at the one in the middle, that is North America. Here we make a small distinction, which you can see in the color coding. There is an additional bar there in blue color coding to show you that the OE segment in North America, or rather in the entire region, but this is driven by North America in particular, grew more than the entire region. This is the 13.7 versus the 11% overall. This is what we have called and are calling today the soaring OE demand. That is also important from a financial perspective, just as a reminder, because this growth comes with lower margin and thus implications for the bottom line overall, plus the additional impacts that I will talk to in just a moment. If we turn to the even more positive side in terms of the growth, you see the performance of Europe across the year. Detlef has just commented on that, that we still feel good about Europe, but we had a particularly strong finish of the year, which was very good to see. China, you see the confirmation of what we have said all along last year. This is the reflection of the evolution of the premium segment, driven by the structural trend in the regulatory environment, helping that premium segment that we play in as an engineering player rather than the volume player in the Chinese market to evolve, and thus we benefit from that reflected in the growth here. Group sales and adjusted EBIT, just quickly, I talked about the almost 100 million in sales growth. On the adjusted EBIT side, yes, we did increase in absolute terms by almost a million, but no, we were not able to increase the margin. Yes, it is in line with what we had forecasted and shared with you, so we did deliver on this promise, but certainly something that we wouldn't want to see like this again, and as you know, we are working on that. During the preliminary earnings release, we introduced you to some of the measures that we call the Management Action Plan for North America to turn the picture into more positive territory, which will then ultimately impact the entire group. Group sales and group adjusted EBIT by quarter. Just two quick comments on the sales side. I know we are limiting the time series here a little bit, but I want to draw your attention to the number of the 274.2 in Q4, a record quarter. If you extend the time series into history to the left, or if you enlarge it, I think we did that during preliminaries, you will see that it was a very strong finish to the year on the sales side. On the margin side, on the adjusted EBIT side, you clearly see the reflection of what happened in the second half of the year with the downturn in the margin, certainly a trend that we wouldn't want to see in the midterm. That is what we're working on, but something that we have to acknowledge is part of our reality at this point, and I will come back to that in just a second. Need to change the slide here as well. Here, the visualization that we introduced last year to help you a little bit to understand the mechanics of the business model, done in qualitative terms with the plus and minus signs on the impacts. You should be used to this by now, which is why I would want to focus more on some of the topics or the highlights to enhance the understanding when we look at the impacts on gross profit. Just as a reminder, when we look at gross profit level, That is where still everything is included, meaning the restructuring costs as well as additional operating costs. You see the absolute numbers here for the full year, meaning the 10.3 million in additional operating costs in the United States alone, and then the 10.9 full year restructuring costs for the U.S. plant consolidation. Those numbers are important to bear in mind, because on the next slide, I will break them down into Q4, which means that you see the high proportion or the high impact that Q4 had when you put them in relation to each other. As such, you see, if I stay on quantitative elements for just 1 second, the disproportionate increase in cost of sales, 11.8% versus the 9.3% on the sales growth side that I had explained earlier, mainly driven this disproportionate increase by the United States. In terms of the factors, of the impact factors on the right-hand side of the slide, today I want to highlight the steel price topic for you. We have commented on that during 2017 already. But those of you who observe the steel market a little more closely will have seen by now that the steel price keeps increasing. Now, the good thing about this is that, and again, just as a reminder, contractually, we are in a fortunate position to be able to pass most of the impacts on to our end customers with a delay that usually takes 6 months. However, we need to be mindful of the fact that if steel prices keep rising, then you actually come to a level where you never really pass on the entire impact, because you only pass on a portion of that, because the rising steel price keeps adding an impact. That is something that you and we will need to closely observe during the course of the year, but at this point, this is a natural impact of the steel prices. Having said that, here is the breakdown of Q4, and if you now look at the gray column in the middle, you see what I just alluded to. If you put the 6.3 Q4 impact on additional operating costs in the United States in Q4 alone, if you put that in relation to the 10.3 on the previous slide, you see that there was a particular impact, a growing impact, if you like. Detlef said it was 4 million in Q3, in Q4 alone. So this soaring demand continued, which also means, quite frankly, that our challenges continued in Q4. However, you also see, and that is the smaller number, the 1.6, if we put the 1.6 in relation to the 10.9 overall cost, this is, if you like, the proof point of the plant consolidation coming to an end technically, because the restructuring costs are coming down. We have closed the plant consolidation as such as of year end. My team is currently in the process of selling the Holland, Michigan real estate, because that is where most of the machinery was that we moved, apart from Muskegon, but Muskegon is obviously a location that we keep. However, and we have talked about this in the preliminary earnings release as well, obviously in the receiving plants, the journey continues, and we now have to translate it into sustainable operational excellence. And given the soaring demand, we're not quite as quick as we would have wanted to be, because our assumption, and Detlef explained that again in his commentary, our assumptions going into 2017 were different. We still believe in the overall impact, positive impact that is, of the plant consolidation, which is why we executed it in full, because the goals and objectives are still valid: proximity to the customers, positive impact, improved supply chains. It's only right now that we're struggling and we need to improve the situation, and we gave you a snapshot of how we intend to do that a few weeks ago. Moving on, the bridge that we normally provide, nothing extraordinary, but the bridge between reported EBIT and adjusted EBIT for the full year, you see the restructuring costs overall were 13.2. Where does the delta come from? Well, it's relatively easily explained. You already have 10.9 restructuring North America, which is the United States. Then there is around about a million, a little more, from Latin America, which is the restructuring of our plants in Brazil. We talked about that in 2017. And then the rest comes from China. Looking at that from a Q4 perspective, just to complete the picture, you see the numbers, nothing particularly to go into detail on. On the next slide, the negative effects on Q4 EBIT and adjusted EBIT in the Americas region. From a segment perspective, it is the Americas, but we're not putting anything on top. These are the United States numbers. We wanted to break down for you the 6.3. We had this picture in the preliminary earnings release for the full year to make you familiar with the different building blocks of those additional operating expenses for the sake of full transparency. And here there are a couple of things to be mindful of or to point out, beginning with the compensation payments. Compensation payments is the term that we use for the penalty, that is the contractual term, when we deliver late to a customer. And if you have soaring demand in the OE business, especially on the truck side, these guys cannot really wait for their product because they have a production line going and these things need to go off and on to the customer. So there is obviously a variety of components and parts that they are waiting for, parts of which come from us. And in one or the other instance, but there was one major customer impact here which makes 80-90% of this number alone, in Q4, where we had to face the compensation payment, and here you see the full number. That is the reason. Expedited freight is still something that is with us, given the situation that we have described. Here, the 2.3 is the expedited freight, which is the freighting the product to the customer. In the block mix and other, more to the right-hand side, that also includes the incoming freight when you have challenges in the supply chain. Because just to avoid a misunderstanding, this is not only an SAF Holland challenge in itself, and not just everything because of our plant consolidation, but a soaring demand and a sudden pickup in the market obviously affects the entire supply chain. Some of the suppliers for us and others are smaller, and they struggle operationally to deliver on time as well. But to speed up the process, every now and then you have to make a conscious management decision to get the things into the door, into our production processes, and that is where we decided to incur some freight costs as well. You then see the other building blocks that I don't want to go into detail on, but that explains the bridge in full transparency, how we arrive at the minus 3.9 for Q4 in the Americas region. Certainly not a number that we're happy about, but there are good reasons, as you can see. With that said, I will take a break for a moment and pass it back to Detlef, who will talk a little bit more about the regions and the distribution between the product lines, at least on the first slide.
Okay, Matthias, enjoy your break. But we will talk later on about the balance sheet, and then he's back on stage. Before we come to that, a little bit more about the regions. Here you see the sales split and the OE business and the aftermarket, pretty stable. 25% of our business is still the aftermarket, and which is, of course, very important for us because here we make the money. And the OE business, 75%, pretty much the same numbers than last year. On the sales split by region, you see a very strong Europe with 53%, or almost more than 53%, followed by Americas, close to 37%, almost 38%, and the rest of the world with 8.6%, a growing number, mainly due to APEC and China, but pretty much a stable development, OE and aftermarket, which is important. Coming to the three regions, I have two favorite slides here. This is one of them. The other one is after the next one. That's our development in Europe, or EMEIE, which is Europe, Middle East, Africa, and India. The development in Europe is, I'm very pleased with that in both, in terms of sales, but especially in terms of profitability. We have been able to increase our business to more than 600 million in euros in Europe last year, 611.8 to be precise. As I said already, strong demand from customers, especially on the trailer side. A little part of that is truck, especially on the trailer side. And with our premium product range, with increasing market shares, I would say very good service to our customers, we are now definitely one of the there are only two market, very big market players in the European trailer market, and we are definitely number one or number two now, at least very close. We have been able to really benefit from the nice market trends, and as I said, with increasing market shares, we have been able to do the 611 million. All markets contributed to that, especially the markets in South Europe, like as you can see here, Spain, Italy, France, also Portugal had a very nice demand last year. That was all due to the pent-up demand from the very low years in 2009, 10, 11, and 12. I would say this is almost done. Okay, the fleets in Europe, Western Europe, are modernized now. But what we see now is huge transport. Demand in transport. This is ongoing, east, west, etc. All this e-commerce is part of that, and we believe that will continue. As I said, Turkey was pretty weak last year, but we have been able to fill the Turkish capacity by one shift. As planned, the ramp-up of the Turkish facility, which we opened last year in March, was very successfully, and we have been able to fill all the production with orders outside Turkey from the neighboring countries. So sales, very good. Even better, profitability, that's what you see on the left-hand side as well. We have realized 11.1% or 67.7 million euros in adjusted EBIT. Both sales and EBIT is an all-time high. We have never been so successful in Europe so far. But there is a but, and that you can see on the last bullet point there. In the late days of December, last days of December, right after Christmas, we saw some extra bonuses from suppliers up to 4.5 million euros. That will not come again. Okay, this is a one-time effect. That was because we had so high volumes, and our contracts with some of our suppliers indicated if we reach a certain volume level, coming above a certain level, we get an extra bonus. That all kicked in late December. Very nice, okay? I'm not complaining at all here, but we need to remind this is a one-time effect, okay? Yeah, that's about Europe. Next region, which is North America, I will not talk about that much about it because you have seen all the numbers already by myself and also presented by Matthias. But as a nutshell, as you can see, from 402 million in 2016 to 400, almost 430 million last year, but adjusted EBIT down to 3.7%. So that means we turned a big wheel, but the output was absolutely not satisfying. All the other things on the right-hand side I will not talk about again. You heard that already. Just two more things here. Mexican market last year, very low. Also this year, we don't see a big improvement here. Mexico is somehow important for us, especially on the aftermarket. But there are really issues in the Mexican market, not with us, but with the market overall. Canada is quite strong, just to report that. Canada is very important for us. And also for this year, we see Canada quite well developing. Okay, Americas, I will jump over that again. We talked about it in detail. This is my second favorite slide here today. This is our development in China APEC. I'm very satisfied with that. I would say we harvest now what we invested in the last couple of years in terms of manpower, in terms of CAPEX, and that you can see here. We grow sales from 70.9 million in 2016 to almost 100 million, 97 million in 2017. Again, this is China and APEC, so the Asia-Pacific region, with the biggest subsidiary in Australia there. So growth, sales-wise, very nice growth, mainly due to China, and we reported on that already the last times. There are two new regulations in place, or there's one new regulation in place already. The next one is to come, The GB1589 is in place, which regulates the maximum load and some dimensions of trucks and trailers in China, which forced fleets to invest in the equipment. They need to buy new trucks and trailers if they would like to be competitive. For example, the maximum weight of a truck-trailer combination in China was now reduced from 58 ton to 49 ton. Just as a comparison, here in Germany we have 40 ton as a maximum. So that means if you run a truck-trailer combination above 49 ton, you're not allowed to use your motorway, the highway, in China anymore. This, of course, is a big disadvantage if your neighbor, if your competitor has new equipment. So the fleets need to buy new equipment, and that is the main reason why we saw last year the 500,000 to 600,000 trailers and almost 900,000 trucks in China last year. We benefit from that because if you need to reduce weight, if you cannot carry that much anymore, then you need lighter products, and that's where we are. That's where we are really good in, light fifth wheels, light axles, suspensions, etc. That is our business. That is our heartbeat, and that's what we can see. To come is that the next regulation, you see the GB7258, which will regulate in the future the use, especially for trucks and trailers who transport dangerous goods, like benzene, diesel, chemicals, all this dangerous stuff. These trucks and trailers need to have disc brakes, air disc brakes, and air suspensions, just to, because of safety. Also here, that's what we are really, where we are really good at. Here in Europe and in North America, as I said, we are market leader. That is our playground. So this is to come. And we also saw that somehow last year, that is one of the reasons why we increased sales so much. And also, just a detour here, I signed a contract 4 weeks ago in China with the local government in Yangzhou, which is an area close to Shanghai, east of Shanghai, very close to Nanjing, where we will build our biggest facility in our universe to keep up this demand which will come in China, especially for trailer axles and suspensions, air suspensions and disc brakes. Our capacity in Xiamen, where we produce today our truck and trailer products, is not sufficient to cover this this business which will come. So we need to be prepared. We will start with the building in a couple of weeks from now and hope to be up and running somewhere in 1 year from now. So after Chinese New Year next year, probably in March, April, we will start production in this new 46,000 square meter big facility. That's about sales, about profitability. That's even better. As you can see, we increased our adjusted EBIT from 3% only in 2016 now to 7.6%. To 7.4 million, which is really nice. Of course, if you do premium products, then you can make some margins. This is pretty much the standard all over the world, and that's what we have seen in the region. Australia was part of it. As I said, Australia is coming back. Back was very low in the last years, but that helped as well. Other markets like Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, are also quite on a good way, and we have subsidiaries down there, also in Thailand, and also we see this pretty positive for the upcoming year. Yeah, that's about the development in the different regions, and with this, I would like to hand back to Matthias talking about the balance sheet.
So was the break long enough?
It was long enough, yeah.
Really needed. Because now I have to take it home, at least for the normal section of this presentation, and then Detlef will talk about the new member of the SAF Holland family. But before we come to that, let's have a closer look at the P&L and its different components and how we get to the result for the period and some comments on earnings per share. Maybe I just take you through it with a couple of comments on the financial result. Nothing spectacular, but the reflection of the fact that we got ready for M&A activities back in the summer of 2016. Here you see the full year impact, which basically explains the full year delta between the 2 years. The result before tax is obviously lower than in the prior period, given what we discussed on the operational side. in terms of the higher impacts than in the previous year, and then obviously the higher or the lower rather, higher interest expenses and lower financial result comes on top of that. On the income tax side, this is obviously not the cash side, but the P&L side. I will explain that in a little bit more detail on one of the next slides, but something to bear in mind when analyzing the situation. Income tax expenses were lower than in 2016 because the result for the period was lower, and then you always have the question, obviously, where profits arise and what the respective tax regime is. Then if we go a little bit further down to the result for the period, whether it's the 41 versus the 43.5, that is pretty close to the previous year. That is obviously the compensating effect of the income tax line item. You see the logical consequence then is the division by the number of shares, which has remained pretty constant, except for a very small conversion of one of the convertible equity holders, but it is a small conversion, so basically you divide by pretty much the same number of shares so that this is still comparable. The one thing and the logical consequence obviously is that this is lower because you have a lower result to divide the shares into. The one thing I wanted to point out to you, which is not on this slide, but you might come across it and ask yourself the question, if you look at the end of the press release this morning, there is some quarterly data on EPS included there too. You might wonder about the effect on EPS in Q4 on a standalone basis, because all of a sudden the adjusted basic EPS result is lower. It is 24 euro cent for the fourth quarter compared to the basic EPS number of 26 euro cent. Here we have the IFRS impact, meaning the rules under IFRS around which tax rate that you use, and this is the higher one for the computation purposes, and that causes the mathematical result. I just wanted to explain that as some background commentary in case you come across that and ask yourself that question. I alluded to the tax side of the house or of the P&L already. Here, what we would like to share with you is that we had two one-time effects, one from the U.S. tax reform, the other one from recognizing deferred tax assets. They have an opposite sign. The impact from the U.S. tax reform is 4.5 million. In contrast to that, we had to let go, so to say, or expense some of the deferred tax assets that we had on the balance sheet, which is due to some of the loss carry forwards that we do not anticipate to be able to use as we thought in the past, which is why you take down the deferred tax asset. Obviously, deferred tax assets always depend on the profitability of the subsidiaries or the jurisdiction that they come from, that they relate to. So this might change again in the future as profitability will hopefully evolve positively. If we do this a similar approach on free cash flow, allow me to start at the bottom line. I know that some of you might have expected a higher number in terms of the free cash flow. However, I did say during 2017, I guided very carefully and ended up in the last publications and the calls that we had, I said somewhere around 30. And that is what we did deliver. We delivered 29.7. If you go through it, the one piece, because this is now a reflection of what I discussed before as far as expense and cash outflow are the same. This is not the case on the tax side. You see on the income tax side there that we cash effective portion of the income taxes was higher than in 2016. That is something noteworthy. And the other item I wanted to point out, because it sticks out a little bit, is the change in net working capital, minus 25. That is mainly driven by some FX translation effects. We look, however, at some of the more operational aspects of generating free cash flow and what I had committed to you in terms of the focus that the organization would have on generating free cash flow. Here are some of the proof points. I said we keep the focus and that I would be confident that we deliver this in Q4. Yes, there are some usual or regular seasonal effects in our business in Q4 with regard to inventory management, but also how we deal with customers and how we pay our own bills. That's the nature of the game in working capital management. Yet, the free cash flow reaching 30 million also means that we refinance our dividend for 2017, right? Whether you look at that at the dividend paid out for 2016 or the future dividend to be paid out, which I have on the next slide, doesn't really matter because the sum is 20 million that we have paid out this year and last year in 2017 and 2018 for 2017, it will be 20.4 million. So we're good to cover those amounts with our own cash flow generation, which we deem to be positive. The other piece to be considered here is on the right-hand side, the last two bullet points, is the disproportionately low increase in inventories compared to the sales growth. You saw some of the sales growth that we have seen in the regions in Q4, and inventory was managed very diligently against that. Yet, we paid very close attention to the fact that if you leave a year, you also have to start a new one. What do I mean by that? You obviously cannot just drive down your inventory just like that for December 31, and then you come back into the plant on January 2nd and you want to produce and all your inventories are gone, right? Or you have to wait for a week for people to supply. So what I'm trying to describe is the operational logic and the fact that we managed this very diligently because Detlef had already described that we had a busy start into 2018 and we were able to deliver against that because we had the inventory that we needed. This is then reflected, just as the last point on this slide, in a reduced number on days of inventory. It came down to 53 compared to 57 at the end of last year. I talked about dividend already, which is the next slide. We're raising our dividend for the financial year 2017 to be paid out this side of the calendar, i.e. in 2018, from 44 eurocents per share to 45 eurocents per share, generating a dividend yield around 3%. The absolute dividend sum I mentioned will be 20.4 million to be proposed at the annual general meeting. That's the caveat that I have to make, but we're confident that this will find the approval of our shareholders as well. Now, the last piece that I owe you is a repetition of the outlook that we provided. Where's the picture? Oh, okay, sorry. It's a repetition of the outlook, financial targets 2018 and midterm planning 2020. Again, as a reminder, strategy 2020 is in place. It hasn't changed. The financial aspirations remain the same. We're confident that we can get there, and we are ahead of the curve when it comes to the organic growth. If you go back to when we published strategy 2020 in 2015, it was based on the year-end revenue in 2014, and then if you do the number crunching, what the CAGR would have been or would have been needed to take us to 2020, you see that at the end of 2017, at least, we're a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of the organic growth, and that gives us confidence going forward. If we look at 2018, just a couple of reminders, you see the footnote around the overall assumption. Of course, it's also assuming that is then in the first text box there, stable FX rates and an unchanged scope of consolidation. Why is that important today? Because Detlef will talk about an acquisition that we're announcing today that is not yet included in this guidance because that is the nature of the unchanged scope of consolidation. Everything else has stayed the same compared to what you have seen a few weeks ago. The last piece I want to point out one more time is the delta on the CapEx side between our relatively usual run rate, which you see depicted in Strategy 2020, 26 to 28 million euro. We spent a little bit more than 27 million in 2017. This will be higher in the financial year 2018. And one of the major building blocks in this to give you that bridge is exactly what Detlef described a few moments ago, is the China Greenfield project. In terms of the CapEx content, we made a couple of changes in the emphasis. We continue to invest in the area of digital, including IT. IT has a slightly higher share in 2018 to be able to execute some projects, to work around digital and to take the organization to the next level, beginning with the infrastructure and then following on the application side. That is what I had for you today. I look forward to Q&A, but now is not time for Q&A yet, because we changed speakers one more time, and Detlef will talk a little bit about Orlando.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Matthias, for guiding us through the P&L and the balance sheet. The last couple of slides is about our latest acquisition from this, announced this morning. Company Orlandi in Italy. Who is Orlandi? Couple of information about that. But before I come to that, I would like to give a little bit about background, about the history of the relationship between Orlandi and SAF Holland. Orlandi is on our wish list for many years. Okay. I know the owner, Gian Pedro, for more than 15 years. We start talking about a closer relationship 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago. But for many reasons, it never really worked. But then, I would say roughly a year ago, we really started very serious discussions, 1.5 years ago, and now it's done. So I'm very happy, I'm very glad that finally Gian Pedro and his team is now part of the big team, of the SAF Holland team. We have been the distributor from Orlandi products in many countries in the past, especially in Europe, for example, very successful in Poland, etc. So we know the company very well, we know the products very well, and as I said, it was always very obvious that this company, Orlandi, and us, that we fit together very nicely. That is one thing. The other thing is we are very familiar with couplings in North America. Most of you might not know this, because we never really talk about it, but couplings in North America is a $20 to $30 million business each year for us, very profitable. It is not our biggest product group. It's much smaller than fifth wheels, landing gears, axle suspensions, but couplings is what we do for more than 50 years now. The thing is, a North American coupler and a European coupler are totally, they do the same. They pull a vehicle, okay? They pull something. But the dimensions, technical specifications, et cetera, are totally different. They look different, so that means if you produce a coupling in North America, you cannot sell it outside North America. If you try to sell a European coupling product in North America, no way. Totally different. Holland, as I said, as part of SAF Holland, is in this business for decades. And it was always a miss from us to say, why the hell can we not sell couplings outside North America, because we are so successful with this in North America. And Orlandi was the right thing. There are mainly two competitors for Orlandi. One is Just, some of you might know them, and the other one is VPG, a Swedish company, and Orlandi is number three in this. The company was established 1858. So even older than SAF, established 1881. Okay, so a long, long history. But today's owner, Mr. Mascalino, Gian Pedro, his family took over the company in 1989. Okay, so and since then they developed them. They are located close to Brescia. They have two facilities. Also the headquarters is there. They have roughly 60 people on board. They are the specialty producer or the producer of very special products for trucks and trailers. And that's what you can see here. For trucks, they do couplings and very special fifth wheels, even fifth wheels we don't do. And for trailers, they do couplings, dropper eyes, and all the things which you need to tow a semi-trailer. They service the agriculture industry, truck industry, trailer industry, and the mining industry. And if you know, mining, for example, is always very special. I show later on some pictures. This is very, very severe duty. This is heavy duty as its best. And Orlandi enjoyed already a well-established international sales structure, but, and here comes the, I would say, the caveat on this, of course, with a small company doing only a little bit more than between 20 and 25 million euros in sales, to develop a sales structure globally is difficult. It costs time and costs money. And we see in the combination of these two companies that Orlandi in the future can benefit from our very strong aftermarket and service and OEM network globally very much. That was a missing piece, in the successful story of Orlandi so far. And now we can join forces that will definitely change to the better. The product range, what you can see on this slide, it's an overview. As you can see, as I said, a lot of couplers. 19% of the business is in the agriculture. We are, as SI Holland, we are not in agriculture at all so far. So this is also very, interesting move, because also in the agriculture business, they need a lot of axles and suspensions. We are not in there so far, but with this, this can open also new way to customers. Automotive, that's how they call it. That's for us truck and trailer. Then we have the mining industry, as I said, and as I said, almost couplings, automatic couplings, very products in the absolutely premium range. Okay, you might have seen Orlandi is quite successful in terms of profitability, around 15% adjusted EBIT. You don't find a lot of companies in our markets who are doing this nice margin. Why they are doing that? They are in special products. This is the main reason, and they are really focused on that. Good service, very good reputation. The Orlandi brand name is a very good name in the industry, especially in Europe, but also in markets like Australia, Middle East, and Russia. With this, I come to the sales split of Orlandi. As you can see, very strong in Italy, of course, as an Italian company with this long, long history. They are the market leader in Italy. But the other businesses, 31% is in Europe, and 41% is overseas. That's how they call it. And overseas, and that you can see here on the text here, that is mainly South America, a little bit South America, South Africa, Australia, Middle East, and Russia. They are extremely strong in Russia. For example, the biggest truck OEM in Russia buys all his fifth wheels and couplings from Orlandi. So they have a very unique position there, and also this fits very well to our development in all these regions, and that also fits to our strategy 2020, because here, for example, in China, we see a nice growth potential. Also with this new regulation, I talked about it already 15 minutes ago, they need premium products. Safety is key in China now, and they need couplings. And therefore, that fits very nice into this envelope. As I said, 19% or less than 20% is agriculture. The rest is industrial. Talking about the applications, here you can see some very nice pictures. Very standard, on the left-hand side, a standard combination. There's a truck pulling a drawbar trailer, and, of course, in between, you need a coupling. Axles you can see as well, hopefully then from SIF. In the middle, you see a typical mining application, so a small truck pulling a monster, which gets offshore for coal, iron ore, etc. So that means a truck like that pulls easily 150 to 200 tons. Okay. The same is with this typical road train in Australia. There are, you guys can see, four trailers pulling by one truck. The total weight here is probably 110 to 120 tons. The in-between are couplings. If they fail, there's a problem. If they work, everybody is happy. And Orlandi is really good in that, very good in that. For example, on the right-hand side over there, you see a coupling on a car carrier, car transporter. Rolfo is a typical OEM, trailer OEM, doing car transporter. Our success in China right now, and we published that already, we just signed a contract with Jiangsu, who is the biggest producer for car transporter in China. They need couplings. We have never been able to sell them because we didn't have them. Now, combining our axles, suspensions, landing gears, kingpins, and now with couplings, this is, we believe, a very nice approach to customers. Customers love to do that, and they all would love to limit the number of suppliers, and now having Orlandi with us on board, that will help a lot. Yeah, just some key financials. As I said, we acquired in the first step here 70% of the shares of Orlandi. We have a call option for the remainder. We expect full year sales, 22 million roughly. Expect an annual growth rate so far 3 to 5%. I believe we can do even more than that. Of course, margin accretive, as we said, today Orlandi is at the mid-teens. And this is for years now. So this is not a one-time effect from last year. They didn't polish the numbers. No, this is very sustainable. They have this high profitability for years. We have a pro rata inclusion in our group of consolidation, as Matthias already said, and we are going to close the transaction in Q2. In Q2, that means April. Matthias, is that right?
Correct.
That's your target for, right? Good. And as I said, we believe that's a very nice fit to our family, and as I repeat myself, that was on our wish list for more than 10 years now, and I'm very happy to have Gianpietro with us on board. That's the last sentence. The owner will run the business also in the future. He will remain in the company as the general manager or managing director, and I'm also very happy about that because in our business, it is people business, and therefore it's very important for us that he is still runs the company and will be step-by-step integrated in the SAF Holland world. Yeah, with this, we are at the end of today's presentation, and I believe, Stefan, you will go on.
For example, question. Thank you. Two questions. I'll start with Orlandi. I can see just a lot behind it, but I still have a
question from an investor perspective, playing a little bit devil's advocate here. You paid $40 million for a business that will give you roughly $2.3 million in EBIT. The value of the market at 9 to 10 times EV EBIT, so that 2.3 million is 20 million. So basically, you've just lost 20 million in enterprise value. Why is that a good deal?
Finance guy or business guy? Okay, good. Thanks for the question, Mr. Ludwig. That is the obvious question when you look at the numbers, of course. Allow me to answer with a return question initially, and I don't mean to be impolite, but what is cheap these days? If we look at asset prices, the inflationary trend for assets out in the market to be acquired, that doesn't go past our industry. There are people hunting assets out there in our industry as well. It might not always be visible, but there is a consolidation going on. There is a hunt for those profitable assets. To look at this in more detail and to focus on SAF Holland now, if you look at the last slide, the last sentence here on this slide, that is still on there, that is the key piece. Obviously, that is not obvious from the face value numbers. But rest assured that we have built ourselves a business case with our own aspirations around this as to where we want to take the business, but also where we want that business to take us. Because at the risk of being repetitive,
there is two things that happen here. Detlef described very clearly the addition on the product portfolio, number one, but also number two, the geographic element of this in the pie chart. We have always said that our M&A has three directions: geography, product portfolio, and technology, two of which are met here. And this means that we have acquired a target that was on our shortlist for a while that can take us into new geographies and with new products to new customers. Now, just to be very clear, this does not mean that this will refinance itself or bring the profit to the business out of the core Orlandi business only. Of course, an integral part of the business case for ourselves here is that we will go with the new colleagues into their customer base and vice versa. So if you like, it cuts both ways, and we're confident that over time we will have conversations with you and the investor base to give you comfort that we didn't just lose 20 million. I hope that's acceptable as an answer.
Yes, thank you. And a quick follow-up on this topic and then one more question. So as you already said, prices are high at the moment. You've always been talking about additional acquisitions. So is this a kind of a price or a multiple we should calculate with also for future acquisitions? They're going to be higher?
We are working on several projects. Of course, this is a small one. This was nothing to do. Hunting them for years now. And by the way, and I would like to add to Matthias' comment here, we have been not the only one looking for this type of the last couple of months. Seller market, very clear. So, is timing right now? Timing is never right. So therefore, we do it now, even though it is a little bit pricey. I agree with that. But overall, this is a multiple which this is a small target. Willing to pay.
Thank you. Then I would like to ask on the U.S. You've given us a good explanation what happened last year. Looking forward, how much do you think of the, let's say, missed or lost aftermarket business that you couldn't do last year, you would be able to regain this year? Or is this year, due to the stronger of the market, another year will basically have to focus on OEMs only and no after or limited aftermarket business?
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe on the aftermarket side, we don't really miss. In most cases, our direct customers, big dealers, the most only can sell spare parts. So what we're doing now and what they're doing is they're buying from somebody, okay, to get the spare parts somewhere to serve the customers, which are these. And most of them have now a pretty empty stock now, okay, so they need to wait a little bit longer. It means our lead time is not 2 weeks anymore for spare parts, now it's probably 5, 6, 8 weeks. Depends really on the part, but we don't really lose a lot of stuff. Just if we come later. It's a problem, of course, because nobody would like to run out of stock. Then these people are upset. Also, in terms of breakdowns, for example, that's something we do every time. Okay, if there is an emergency, if there's a breakdown, then we deliver the spare parts. From ever we will get it. Okay, we make everything happen that this is possible. But the dealers need to be a little bit flexible in these days. But most of the spare parts are priority. That means they need to buy them. They don't get them from anybody. Okay. So to answer the question, we will not lose a lot of the aftermarket.
But that means the mix for this year will still be weakish. They were not as good as it could be. Because,
yes, yeah. Because OEM demand is so high. That is, and it, as I said, it will continue. But we will increase capacity, okay, get more efficiency in the plant, etc. So in the balance of the year, we will back to normal times.
Okay.
So we have a question from Egeling.
Thank you. One question basically also around the Italian acquisition. What will happen with the employees and what are your plans regarding the two production plants? And this is also relates to the CapEx. Which role does hyper depreciation play in your plans?
Let me start the first questions. We have planned no changes at all with employees. The team from Holland is a small team, very efficient team, they're good guys, very well trained in the markets for many, many years. And by the way, his production is highly automated. Most of you might know, North Italy is one of the core centers for the industry. And when you see the equipment in Holland, this is top of the notch. This is really one of the reasons why he's able to make 18's margin is specialty product, as I said, but in combination with a very smart production. That means he's able to organize production flow, even though that every single coupling test is different, on a highly optimized way. That means 60 people is not a lot, okay, for this turnover, for this sales. And so we have no intention. The same is with the two factories. They are small factories. I would say very well organized. I see no reason for now to consolidate it somewhere. Maybe to move it. Doesn't make sense. The team there is a good team. And then we can...
Can you, if I may ask, can you specify the term hyper depreciation?
Yes.
Not something that comes across my desk every day. I have to be brutally honest. I apologize.
I think there are some tax regulations in Italy kind of relating to basically capital goods depreciation, which in certain cases, I think when it relates to digitalization, you can depreciate up to 250% of the machine. And in other cases, I'm no tax expert, but in other cases, I heard from 130 to 140% of possible depreciation.
Yeah, thanks for the specification. Now I have a new term in my vocabulary. The interesting piece is that I can actually answer the question very concretely because the company has recently bought some machinery that qualifies for such a scheme under the Italian regulations. However, I would caution us, given the size of the company, to attach too much value to that in terms of P&L computations. However, if we take this as a proof point that this is a professionally run, small, former family business that also looks into such opportunities.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking my question. I have three questions regarding also the Orlandi acquisition. The first one is you mentioned an adjusted EBIT margin of 15% for the company. Could you give us some information on the reported EBIT margin the company has and the adjustments you are making? The second is the growth rate of 3 to 5%. To me, it looks a bit conservative, having in mind all the cross-selling potential you mentioned. Could you give us also or put some color on the historical growth rate the company had? And the last one, just a housekeeping question. The revenues and earnings of Orlandi, will they be distributed across your segments? Is that a fair assumption?
I'll take that question. I will start with a disappointment. I cannot comment much further on the adjusted EBIT question because I don't think it would be prudent to do that. But allow me to be more concrete so that you understand why it doesn't make too much sense. This is a business that comes out of a completely different situation. So when we did look at the numbers and discussed what we present to you, obviously, we have called or pulled a number from the business case assumption that we did, not in terms of a fictitious number, but in terms of a recurring number. So if we take their reported EBIT, because that includes expenses that they have had historically but will not have on a recurring basis going forward, that would lead us astray. So I do not think that that would be a good comparable. Rather, I would ask you to trust us with the number that we have chosen here. In terms of the growth rate, I hear where you're coming from. Allow me to comment by saying, yes, it might be a little bit conservative. The business is healthy, it is growing. However, forgive us for being a little bit conservative, because we're also taking this organization into an acquisition process, into an integration process, and while it will run as a standalone business and operate on its own, there is some integration work to be done. There are meetings to be held and so on. And so let's leave it at that for the moment, and then we see where that takes us across the year. In terms of the cross-selling, that is the same question, but let me just emphasize that again. Very concretely, we will be down in Italy with the entire management board of SAF Holland next week to kick off integration activities, to define very concretely go-to-market structures, business models, and so on. And this obviously doesn't fall from the sky in terms of the execution. The two organizations need to meet each other. They need to get to know each other. We need to exchange further information that you are not allowed to exchange during an M&A negotiation. So this, what I'm trying to describe, is a process that will now take a moment of time before those impacts kick in. Can you just remind me of the third part of your question, because I just wrote down revenues and earnings.
Yeah, no problem. The third question just was if revenues and earnings from Orlandi will be distributed across your three segments.
Yeah. Yes, that's the plan, because we will not change the approach to segment reporting. So they will go into the respective regions. Given the size of the acquisition at this point, I do not think it makes too much sense to break it out or make it a standalone segment, because we have moved away from the product-based segment reporting not too long ago, so we will stay with the regional approach.
I think there was a question before.
Just a quick follow-up, if I may, just a short follow-up to the first question. I understand that you are making adjustments for recent years for Orlandi, because it was a family business. But did I understand you correctly that there will be no huge adjustments for coming years?
That's correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Finally.
Thanks. I also have a few questions. The first on Orlandi again. So my understanding is that Orlandi's aftermarket exposure is still below the group level. So it points into the same direction, the 3-5% sales growth you're anticipating. Does this already include an expansion of the aftermarket business?
In fact, the aftermarket business for Orlandi is lower than 25% we have in the aftermarket, but we have intentionally increased it because, as I said, we have the sales distribution network in all this market. Matthias already said that the 3-5% growth rate sounds conservative. It is conservative, but for now, I would say.
Then just a housekeeping question. Might be a little bit too early, but can you give us a first indication on integration costs? So it sounds like it should be a rather smallish amount. But
some nice wine.
Okay. So it sounds very expensive.
Yeah, this is next week, okay? The entire management team, yeah, that's costly. No, to be very serious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe I can just to round that off, if I may, so that you have the right impression and takeaway from the company. In terms of integration costs, it is important to remember this is a company that produces in Italy and then ships and distributes across the world. So it is very asset light from that perspective, and then their go-to-market and sales either goes directly
through the mothership, through the company itself out of Italy, or through dealers and partners that they have in their respective countries. So there is no infrastructure cost that we need to look at and integrate with our own infrastructure, which is why we perceive the integration cost to be relatively low.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Then another question on M&A in general. I mean, you highlighted the three pillars, end market, regions, and technology expansion. Can you give us an idea on your next targets on the list? So obviously, I think the disappointment or the first initial disappointment on the M&A today was obviously on the one hand the rather high price tag, but on the other hand kind of the lack of technology exposure, although you mentioned the coupling issue with the North American product. So could you shed some light on ongoing M&A activities you're thinking about? And should we also expect another diversification away from truck and trailer like we've seen this from the Orlandi acquisition?
We are that currently working on other projects as well, as we always. Okay, we have always things on our to-do list. Years now, we identified that, of course, with 2015. In an ideal world, okay, our targets fulfill all three dimensions, as Matthias indicated, but the next one probably will be more the product and regional. Like to see, and then especially in the emerging markets, because as you might know, one of the targets on our strategy 2020 is to increase sales in outside North America and Europe, stands today for roughly 90% of our sales. To increase the sales outside into regions, to regions, up to 30%. So it means a regional hold on would be good. And if this comes along with additional products, question regarding product enhancement, we will show that's also part of our study 2020. It's truck and trailer and bus. And everything which is chassis related. I mean, everything which is connected to the chassis, that is what we are. That is part of our study. So we will not do rubber boots or smartphones. We will stay in what we are. Regarding technology, third part, which is of course Matthias' hobby here. Also, we work on this. This has to do with our digitalization strategy, smart steel, and I believe we talked about it already last time. There we looking for, probably startups, small, fast companies who are, let's say, more in the digital world, in the bits and bytes world. As you know, we are more the old economy steel guys here, and we are looking for some targets there as well. But this will be then probably more smaller things, not multi-billion whatever companies. So we have a nice, I would say, nice setup of some selected targets where we're looking for and wait and see.
And if I may, I still have two questions on the U.S. So the one is, I mean, we've seen a steep increase of demand for Class 8 order intake. Can you give us an impression, what's your view on the ELD impact from this increase? Which
can you say it again?
What's the ELD impact is, or the ELD implementation, what's the impact from this on the increased order intake? Or to put it the other way around, I mean, we have recently seen FTA to even increase the order intake forecast for Class 8, also referring to ELD. And the question for me is this level we are kind of a sustainable level, or will we really see a fall off the cliffs in 2019? And another question on the U.S. would be, what's the impact of Trump's imposed steel tariffs on your business, and what should we expect with regards to add-on operating expenses in the first half from the plant consolidation?
Okay, let me start with Mr. Trump first. The impact for us is, it's limited, okay? We will struggle with steel price increase anyhow. Matthias talked about it in length.
That is a challenge for us to keep on the price increases to pass on the price increases to our customers. This is a big challenge right now. We had just yesterday a meeting with our global purchase organization talking about this. So when you look to the forecast from CRU, which forecast all the steel price development, there is even more to come. The only good thing is, if I can say good thing, is that we source all of our steel in America. Okay, what we import to America is not raw steel. These are components or parts where we don't see any tariffs. So that means if we source locally, then this is a local issue. We believe that most of our competitors, even the big one competitors, are in exactly the same situation, so we are all in the same ballpark. That means, basically, I don't see an issue there. We are playing in the same game here. But it is a challenge, again, steel price increase, and we are talking about big numbers. That's what we see. There are first predictions and that the price per ton for raw steel will go up to $1,000. We are right now at $600. Prediction is for the next 2 months up to $750. So there are first indications up to $1,000. If this will happen, whoop, I've never seen that before. But okay, we will manage that. As I said, our competitors are in the same. We believe in the same position. So I don't see really an issue with that. Regarding the forecast for Truck 8 order intake, regarding the ELI, we see that also in 2019. I believe I said that already. When you look at the forecasts from FDR, ACT, etc., this will continue. Plus, we see really the big demand for the high transport volume. Driver shortage is the big problem, still the big problem for years now, and it will increase even more. And the American industry is somehow booming. That's very clear. We see that it's more and more difficult to get people. So there is no reason so far that this trend will not continue also in 2019. But what was the third question? Sorry.
If I heard it correctly, was the impact of restructuring in the first? Yeah. I'll take a shot at that. Maybe a comment overall first to introduce the answer on restructuring costs overall to be expected in 2018, because you have seen over time that these expenses or restructuring costs that we adjust have increased, particularly in the past year. For 2018, at this point, given the current planning and what we know as of today, we expect a single mid-digit number for the full year, which is a reflection of the fact that the plant consolidation is completed. Yet, plant consolidation is completed technically. We moved machinery. We trained people. The plants have received. But now, as I said earlier, we need to translate that into sustainable operational excellence. That is the impact that you are asking about. This is, for the moment, continuing. We will see impact during Q1 as well, and we will need to see how big they will be. But given the soaring demand that continued, and Detlef had it on its slide about the market expectations for the year, there is an ongoing impact in our operations. We are working on that, as you know. But expected for the first quarter, and maybe a little bit at the beginning of the second quarter, but it is too early to say, and I ask for your understanding that our focus is more on solving the issue than speculating about the impact.
Good morning, thank you. So just in terms of the U.S. plant consolidation, I can understand the streamlining and the optimization benefits, but if we compare the new Finnish network to the old network, how will that look in terms of total capacity?
Yeah, what we shifted is equipment to produce fifth wheels, truck and bus suspensions. Okay. With this, I would say we shifted that to a factory in Cincinnati, Wiley, and partly Dumas. So capacity-wise, I would say we are good. Okay, even if there's the increasing demand, we can fulfill that. What is to come is our on the trailer side, trailer axles and suspensions. We didn't touch that because that is so far located in our facility in Warrington and partly in Dumas, and where we need to have additional capacity. We will invest this. This is part of the 35 to 40 million capex for this year. We need to increase our capacity for trailer axle suspensions, especially for disc brakes and for air suspensions, because we have seen some very nice orders. We expect some even more nice orders, we need to have more capacity. We are at the limit right now. But again, this is part of, is already in our today capex plan.
Thank you. And then just following on from that, in terms of the cost savings to be made from when this all begins to flow through, how should we think about these right now and even quantify them?
I can take that. So the key message remains in place. We still believe in the business case. I said that earlier, giving us that single mid-digit relief number that we discussed frequently before. However, given where we stand right now, it will be a number that kicks in, if you like, pro rata. So I wouldn't calculate with a single mid-digit number for the full year, but rather a portion thereof for the remainder of the year once we have fixed the issue. I think that is a fair assumption.
Any more questions? Ludwig, follow-up question?
Mr. Ludwig, I'm hungry. We need to...
I'll be quick. As you talked about the steel price a lot of times, could you give us an idea how much steel you actually purchase per year? So how big the impact will be for a 10% steel price rise?
That is a good question. I would say the impact could be... it depends, really. Okay, I just mentioned the $750, maybe $790, what we see so far in the forecast. I don't talk about the $1,000 per ton. But the impact in North America only, if you go to the 780 whatever dollars, could be 6 to 7 million U.S. dollar, which we need to gain back from our customers. That is a rough, very rough number. Okay. The question is, what is the rest of the world? Because we use even more steel in Europe, plus China, and this is now the wild card here. If all the steel producers from Brazil, Europe, and China cannot export to U.S. anymore, they need to find new markets. Okay, that could be Europe. Then what will happen with the steel price in Europe? It might go down, but this is just speculations. We don't know. We don't do any hedging. Okay, we manage that. That's how we do it for 30 years now. There's a normal situation, steel price going up and down. It is a very volatile thing. It's important for us, as we mentioned, but we can manage that.
If I may just add, to avoid any misunderstanding or confusion, the reason why we're hedging is not that we're ignorant of the price volatility in the steel price market, but that the underlying that we would need to hedge is extremely complicated to hedge in terms of the execution and finding an appropriate instrument that actually meets our purpose. We have investigated this more than once, rest assured, but at this point we have not found an adequate solution for that.
Any further questions? Seems not to be the case, so we would conclude today's analyst conference. By the way, make sure to take your SF Holland clock along. This is what our apprentice did for you. So you always be on time with the SF Holland clock.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.